Good evening, everyone. Tonight's talk is called Making Friends with the Hindrances. Once, the Brahmin Sangharva came to see the Buddha to ask for some advice. He wanted to know the reason why it was that sometimes his meditation was not at all clear to him, but at other times it was. The Buddha, understanding exactly the cause of the Brahmin's problem, explained what was happening by way of a simile. Suppose, Brahmin, a pot of water was mixed with lac, turmeric, blue and yellow dye, and a man with eyes to see were to look there to see his own face reflected. He would not know it. He would not see it as it really was. Even so, Brahmin, when one dwells with a mind possessed by lust and passion, overwhelmed by lust and passion, and knows not the escape thereof as it really is, then he knows not, sees not the goal as it really is. The Buddha then goes on to compare a pot of water heated on the fire, boiling up and bubbling over with a mind possessed by ill will. A pot of water covered over with slimy moss and water plants he likened to a mind possessed by sloth and torpor. A pot of water shaken in the wind so that the water trembles and ripples is compared to a mind possessed by flurry and worry. And a pot of water stirred up, made muddy, and set in a darkened room is likened to a mind possessed by doubt. In each case, the Buddha said, if a man with eyes to see were to look in the water to see his own face reflected, he would not know it, he would not see it as it really was. In the same way, when the mind is possessed and overwhelmed with any of the five hindrances and does not know the escape from them, then he cannot see the goal as it really is. The goal the Buddha refers to is the ability to see the true nature of one's own mind. And I'm sure Sangharva's complaint is a familiar one to all of us. The Buddha's teaching, the Dhamma, has only one function: to show those that are interested the way to the end of all suffering. The Buddha made known the way to rid ourselves of all mental agitation and pollution. He taught a way to uncover the mind's inherently pure nature, a mind that, no matter what storms may rage on the surface, experiences deep and abiding peace, what the Buddha called Nibbana. To do so, we train our minds to become alert and still enough to observe the truth of what goes on at the deepest and most subtle levels of our being. Ultimately, that observation brings profound understanding that finally eradicates all inner conflict. What remains is the simple contentment and peace of our true nature. An untrained mind cannot penetrate these subtle truths. Without mental development, all attempts to observe the workings of the mind will be thwarted until we have learned how to quieten the surface levels of mental activity. The cause of this surface agitation are the five hindrances, and they can make our meditations a torrid battleground. On the one hand, these are deeply embedded habit patterns demanding to be exercised as usual. On the other, there is a pressing urge to be free of them in order, we think, to advance. To make matters worse, these mental monsters seem to feed on resistance. The more effort to put in to control them, the more they take control. The hindrances destroy the balance of our mind sap our energy and our enthusiasm. It's easy to hate them for all the damage they do. But this merely creates another schism in the mind, and so cannot be the answer. It is possible to resolve all this conflict, but to do so, we need to adopt an attitude that accepts the hindrances as a vital part of our meditation rather than an obstacle to it. This way, they are brought under control not through force, but by paying wise attention to them and learning from the experience. The question is, if they cause so much grief, why on earth do we do them at all? Well, the simple answer is, because we always have. It certainly isn't the case that they began to appear the day we started meditating. They have always been happening. It's just that we've never looked at them directly. Actually, we regularly employ the hindrances in daily life as ways of avoiding unwanted situations. For instance, we try to overcome pain and dissatisfaction by indulging the senses. We go out shopping, drinking and dancing, or dream up next year's summer holiday. Alternately, we try and destroy what we believe to be the cause of our discontent, so we may speak harshly, commit acts of violence, or plot someone's downfall. When depressed, we may choose to slump in an armchair, preferring to remain inert rather than summoning up the energy needed to solve a problem. Or solving the problem becomes an obsession, and we chew over the causes, ramifications, and possible solutions to our distress incessantly. Either that, or being unable to determine the reasons for our troubles, we admit defeat, concluding that we're just useless, and escape that way. These mental activities are habitual, which indicates, superficially at least, that they must have been effective. Yet they cannot have provided a proper solution. If they had, we wouldn't be sat here tonight. Now, via meditation, we see that these methods actually cause distress and have rightly concluded that they're a bad idea. However, that doesn't mean the hindrances will no longer trouble us. These are deeply entrenched habits of mind. We've been developing our capacity to indulge, destroy, sleep, fret, and doubt our way out of problems for years, if not lifetimes. They still represent the line of least resistance when faced with the difficulties of life and meditation. In a meditation interview, a meditator sits, slumped in a chair. Opposite him sits his teacher. "So," the teacher asks, "how's it going?" "Awful." "Tell me more." The meditator reads from his notes. "Well, the meditation starts okay. Everything's calm and I'm on the rise and fall. But I've recently started a new relationship and I can't stop thinking about her. I just go into daydream and fantasy. Then I start to worry about what she's up to and I get a bit anxious. I start wondering if I could sneak out and call her, you know, just to set my mind at rest. Oh, then I get in a real state. I start hating myself for being so weak. I think, why can't I just forget it? Oh, why don't I go back to the rise and fall? Oh, perhaps I should be noting a hindrance. But which one? Sensual desire? Worry? Hatred? Oh no, I'm doing them all. So I get confused and I don't know what I should do next. In the end I think, oh, why bother? And I just go to sleep. Much to the meditator's astonishment, his teacher looks genuinely pleased and congratulates him. "That's the best meditation report you've ever given me," he says. "A real improvement," he explains. "For the first time, you're telling me what's actually going on, which shows a real reduction in the amount of self-concern you have. Your mindfulness isn't so bad either. Lack of mindfulness and self-concern are the lifeblood and oxygen of the hindrances. Without mindfulness being established in the meditation, a hindrance will happily run endlessly. It's a thin line between thinking worry thoughts and realizing we're thinking worry thoughts. Self-concern is where we identify with the hindrance, saying, this is me, this is mine, this is myself. Believing that to be the case, we wrestle with the hindrance. We push and we pull the mind around, trying to get it peaceful and calm, but such behavior only increases the problem. This is called clinging, and the more we fight, the longer the tyranny of the hindrances is going to last. Meditation is all about letting go of self-concern. It's not doing, it's refraining from doing. It's learning to stop trying always to take control. We learn to restrain those urges, and in doing so, deprive the hindrances of the energy they need. To try to capture the feel we need when we sit down to meditate, consider a tree. A tree is always completely open to everything and never complains. It might rain, the sun may shine, a couple may picnic under its canopy, a bird might nest in its branches, but no matter what happens, the tree remains completely unmoved, open and accepting. Exactly the same quality is needed from the moment we begin the meditation. Whether it's worry, doubt, a pain in the back, bliss, tranquility, or a moment of insight, we need the same open attitude. We need to learn to accept whatever occurs, regardless of whether we think it's good or bad, and just watch. Of course, it isn't that easy, especially at the beginning of our training. As we all know, the hindrances can be pernicious in the extreme. Yet it's important to recognize that they only appear in mind because we created the habit pattern. But that definitely doesn't mean self-criticism. Laying into ourselves because we can't stop daydreaming isn't helpful, it's hateful. Why make things worse by adding another hindrance into the mix? The reason we do blame ourselves may have something to do with our expectations. We respond passionately because, understandably, we want the meditation to be a success. Usually, definitions of success include wishing to experience such qualities as peace, clarity, bliss, or insight. Seldom will a meditator consider as a success a meditation spent thinking about last year's holiday. But if that's what happened, that's what happened. Moaning because we wish it had been different just creates further unpleasant feeling. The aim is to observe what actually happens in the mind without bias, without judgment, and to learn from the experience. The best thing we can do is to abandon our expectations. They are always false and only get in the way. Dealing with the hindrances is complex, but it's a rite of passage every meditator goes through. There's an expression that goes, simplicity lies the other side of complexity. If we approach the task in the right way, we will find that with time, commitment, and wise attention, the situation will clarify itself. The way the training in meditation unfolds is perfectly summed up in the following extract by American writer Portia Nelson. It's called Autobiography in Five Chapters. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the pavement. I fall in. I am lost. I am hopeless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the pavement. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the pavement. I see it is there. I still fall in. Ah, it's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the pavement. I walk round it. And chapter 5. I walk down another street. For many, meditation can be just like falling into that hole in the street. We get caught up in the hindrances without quite knowing how. And we don't yet have sufficient knowledge of the territory to find our way out quickly. To overcome this requires us to develop the ability to ponder our experience. We do this in order to understand the nature of the hindrance that has arisen and skillfully apply a counter to it. One easy way to ponder is to consider how, when a hindrance is running, we lose the balance of our mind. If we understand what's happening, we can apply a counter that rebalances us and devalues the hindrance. For instance, when sense desire is running, we might decide to take time to consider the loathsome aspect of the object desired. After all, nothing is all good. There are two sides to every coin. When we lust after anything, we must deliberately ignore its less savory side. If delight in food takes hold, consider what happens to the food after we have enjoyed consuming it. Thinking like this, it shouldn't be too long before the desire is quelled. If hatred arises, we can do the opposite. Here, we deliberately turn our attention to the object under fire and consider its good points. Alternatively, we might recall that karma is one's own, and that the results of hatred are always painful. It makes us look stupid and unpleasant to be around. People will be less inclined to give us a helping hand, and we'll feel left out and isolated. Thinking intelligently like this will certainly undermine hatred. Sloth is a difficult hindrance to counter. Primarily, this is because it's impossible to ponder when you're fast asleep. But if we establish mindfulness and sense drowsiness coming on, there are some tricks we can apply. Because this is the lazy mind, we counter its effects by applying more energy. We can start directing the attention to different parts of the body in order to keep the mind moving. Another way to dispel the murk is to imagine a bright light in or above the head. Before a meditation, we could slap cold water on the face or go for a walk outside. In fact, doing anything physically energetic will help undermine sleepiness. To counter worry, we need to take a practical and pragmatic view of this kind of thinking. Consider the form worry takes and its function. Its form is to obsessively turn over a dilemma in the mind with a stubborn refusal to let go. Its function is to solve a problem and thereby bring us happiness. To counter it, we can ask ourselves questions like, Do I have what I need to solve this issue? Or, if not, can I get what I need? If the answer is still no, then there's nothing I can do at this time. If the issue could be solved sitting in meditation, I would solve it, and so there would be no worry. If it isn't solvable in the meditation, why bother spending the whole time worrying? Further, we can reflect that worrying never results in happiness. Happiness is when worrying stops. A better policy is to resolve to sort it out afterwards, if possible, and then forget it. To counter doubt, we need to recognize that the wavering mind achieves nothing. The balance is found by choosing a course of action and sticking to it for a predefined period of time. Developing excessive confidence makes our meditation far more decisive and dynamic. If we make the wrong choice, we usually know fairly quickly and find that, far from having done any harm, we have actually learned something very valuable from the experience. We know for sure now what not to do in that particular situation, and our meditation is stronger for it. We can always contact a teacher afterwards and ask for guidance. Good friendship and profitable talk will help to undermine all the hindrances. If over time we find no real let up with the hindrances, we need to consider changing aspects of our lifestyle. How much we socialize, the kind of and amount of work we do, and our ethical behavior all have an effect. If it is to advance, meditation cannot be kept separate from the rest of our life. It can never just be the thing we do on Wednesday nights. We need to ponder intelligently the reasons behind such things like the precepts, sense restraint, and contentment with little. Ultimately, we embrace these ideas not because the teacher tells us to, or because it sounds reasonable. Rather, if we're serious, it's the meditation itself that will convince us that change is required. Finally, we must develop skill in concentration. At the House of Inner Tranquility, we recommend the practice of loving kindness. Making much of this meditation will soften and gladden the mind and make it easier to direct and incline it as we wish. It also benefits meditators by greatly reducing levels of hatred, and so brings a sense of friendliness and kinship with all life. It also reduces self-concern, which is vital for our overall aim. With time and application, our meditations gradually become clearer. We see how it is that we fall into that deep hole in the pavement and how to get out again. It becomes apparent that it is possible to restrain the habit of leaping into the hindrances, and we begin to experience freedom from them. More and more often, we reach momentary concentration, where mental control has reached sufficient strength to suppress the hindrances temporarily. This state is calm, peaceful, and open, quite unlike the mind beset with hindrances. The Buddha said of the meditator who clearly sees that the five hindrances have been got rid of, as feeling as though free from debt, free from disease, free from imprisonment, free from enslavement, and as having reached a place of safety after a dangerous journey. Seeing such, that meditator becomes gladdened. This gladness gives rise to delight, and the delighted mind generates calm. The meditator who enjoys calmness experiences bliss, and being blissful, his mind gains concentration. With such concentration established, the surface levels of the mind have finally quietened down. Just as a man with eyes to see, looking in still water, would see his own face reflected, now it is possible to see the true nature of our own mind. This is where observation of impermanence, suffering, and non-self really comes into its own. The hindrances, although subdued, still appear from time to time, but now it's like walking down the street, seeing the whole, and walking straight past. Through repeated observation, we come to realize that a hindrance can only be maintained due to a fundamental ignorance of the impermanent, unsatisfactory, and impersonal nature of experience. Everything we look at, we find to be in a constant flux. Nothing in existence is static or enduring. There are only conditioned and conditioning processes at work. Whenever we fall into a hindrance, at that time, we believe we can manipulate and control that flux. We attempt to arrange sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and thoughts exactly as we wish them to be, and importantly, we believe we can keep them that way. This is like standing by the side of a river and commanding it to stop. Yet even the command to stop is actually just another ripple, just another wave in that river. This is because, in truth, there is no separation, no duality at all. There is no permanent me who stands apart from life. There is only life. Whenever we think, this is me, this is mine, this is myself, in regard to any experience, we fall into error. Self is nothing more than a view, an opinion that arises in the mind due to conditions and then vanishes. It too is nothing but a ripple in the river. When a meditator comes to realize deeply enough that this really is the true nature of the mind, ignorance is dispelled and knowledge arises. All attempts at controlling events, regardless of whether they are positive or negative, cease. Instead, there is complete acceptance of whatever occurs. The basis for conflict has gone, and the contradiction has been resolved. By learning how to make friends with the hindrances, we learn how to be friends with our own mind. And in essence, that is the purpose of the Buddha's teaching. This is chapter 5 in the autobiography. We walk down another road. Interestingly, we've come all this way and learned so much about how our mind works in order to win emancipation from suffering, only to find out that everything is perfect as it is and always has been. It's just now we totally accept that fact. So how exactly is walking down another road any different? Concerning the enlightened mind, Jackie James said this: it's very, very revolutionized, and yet it's still the same. It's just the way you look at it has changed. The way you look at the same old junk. You're not going to get rid of those negative qualities which you find so difficult to handle. What you'll get rid of is finding them difficult to handle. So just like an ocean, no matter what storms may rage on the surface, in the depths of the enlightened being's mind, there is nothing but sublime and abiding peace. An Oriental master described it like this: profound and tranquil, free from complexity, uncompounded, luminous clarity. Beyond the mind of conceptual ideas, this is the depth of the mind of the victorious ones. In this, there is not a thing to be removed, nor anything that needs to be added. It is merely the immaculate looking naturally at itself. Thank you.